Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Nair FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on this episode, my co-presenter John Dorney is joined by Professor Gavin Foster of the Department of Canadian Irish Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, Quebec, to discuss the Irish Civil War. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to the Nair FM podcast page or check us out on Facebook on www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show.
Gavin Foster, Tim Pat Coogan once said of the Irish Civil War that it was the most pointless war ever fought since the war in Gulliver's Travels between the people who took the top off the boiled egg and people who took the bottom off.
I mean, certainly there is an element of chaos to the conflict where, you know, as a historian trying to study patterns, be they patterns of violence, patterns of allegiance, even ideological consistencies, where sometimes it's difficult to make sense of it. I sometimes think about when somebody sits down to write about the recent Iraq war after the American invasion, mm-hmm. follow the newspaper reports, it's an IED here, it's an explosion here. It's like, I just often wonder how someone is going to narrate mm-hmm. that event, because there's the sheer complexity on the ground, the chaos from day to day, you know. So certainly modern civil wars often have that element. But I would be skeptical or hesitant to ascribe illogic or, you know, irrational character to the conflict for a couple reasons. One of them is the fact that at the time of the Civil War, a lot of Free State press particularly really stressed that what they called irregularism, which was a pejorative term, but one that both meant the anti-treaty IRA, but was also kind of a broader term to encompass all of the social conflict and kind of chaos happening. And they tended to sort of make the case that the people who were opposing the treaty settlements and who were resisting the states and, you know, involved in the military campaign were irrationalists. I mean, that term was literally used, that there was nothing logical or intelligent about it, that it was a war waged by young boys who were too young to have fought in the War of Independence, ergo they are inclined to hooliganism. Young lads out on a, you know, out for a lark. Mm-hmm. This kind of language was often used to divest the Republican movement at the period of any kind of political legitimacy. A similar strain of thought was often applied, as we know, famously by P.S. O'Hegarty, his description of the women in the Dáil, Margaret Pierce and Constance Markovich and the others, as the hysterical women incapable of intelligent, rational political discourse. So there's the risk of a partisan quality to sort of ascribing, you know, irrationality to the conflict. Of course, you could make the claim that the entire conflict, both sides were equally involved in all kinds of irrational actions. And of course, you know, lots of the violence seems pointless. Mm-hmm. Lots of the destruction of the infrastructure and the burning of massive amounts of hay and massive amounts of, you know, of homes and property mm-hmm. was just an absolute waste for the country in this period. So, yeah, I mean, there's an element of that. But, you know, if you look at the issues involved in the treaty debates and the treaty split, and they're not always the same issues that necessarily fueled the war. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, oftentimes we assume the treaty split was the catalyst for the Civil War, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's what everybody was fighting over in 23, you know. Oftentimes there's been a tendency to say it was, you know, if you look at the amount of debate and rhetoric spilled over the oath, mm-hmm. that here was a war fought over the oath. And yeah. then the argument is could there be anything, you know, more irrational than people right. fighting over this abstraction. But I think that there's actually some very significant political and ideological issues at stake, and ones that you could understand how people on both sides could be deeply invested in. One of the things I've been interested in, I wrote a piece a while back about the Republican language and discourses around liberty, and kind of argue that they're are affinities between the way De Valera and Childers and Mellows and other Republican TDs talked about liberty. There's affinities between that and a classical Republican tradition. And in that tradition, the argument is you're concerned as much by threats of coercion and threats of infringements on one's sovereignty as you are about an actual manifestation of it. And De Valera, particularly in the Dáil, was sometimes accused of quibbling over shadows. Mm-hmm. And that was an argument that was made, that the pro-treaty argument were men who were talking about substances, what yeah. we've gained with the treaty, whereas the anti-treaty TDs were talking about shadows and quibbles. And De Valera made the point that the shadows matter, and it's to, you know, why can't we have the shadow mm-hmm. instead of having the crown have the shadow? So while it might seem like hair splitting, I think that there is actually a quite sophisticated point being made there about a certain Republican conception of liberty that says if you set up a constitutional arrangement in which the ultimate source of authority is not rooted in mm-hmm. the people but appears to be in certain symbols of privilege or symbols of another state, then that necessarily precludes the possibility of liberty. So that would be just one example of a potential very significant ideological argument being put forth. But also, you know, there's a tendency to talk about the debates sometimes as, you know, there's plenty of examples of personal attacks and some really negative, at times, kind of fairly pointless quibbling and these things. But, I mean, at the same time, here was this critical, you know, the seminal moment in the revolution, the first time since maybe the first meeting of Dáil Éireann in January of 1919, when and far more TDs are present, when leading figures in the movement across Sinn Féin and the IRA and Cumann na mBan, who are sitting there and for once, finally in one place, talking and debating the, you know, about the aspirations of the revolution, the aspirations of Sinn Féin, with the press watching, people reading the papers, the whole country is immersed in these discussions. And so that's really important. And I think along the way, a lot of really important issues were discussed, you know. And while a lot of the arguments made were emotional, you know, and if we want to say emotional means irrational, then, you know, you can make a claim that people were fighting irrationally. But emotion is part of every political movement and every war. And, you know, for some people, it was perfectly rational to say, I fought for this cause. My friends and comrades and brothers died for this cause. It's irrational to accept something less than what we fought for. I mean, to fight for something and kill for something and then accept something far less could be an argument for something irrational. So, you know, I would push back a little bit on the conception that it's irrational. I mean, I think, yes, there's lots of terrible violence and lots of irrational actions, and certainly, but I think that the issues that were being fought for on both sides, some of the principles, were actually really important ones. You know, a lot was at stake.
Yeah, my take on the oath thing is, if the oath doesn't matter, then why does it matter so much to the British? Because the British absolutely insist on the oath. Throughout early 1922, when Collins is trying to patch up some sort of agreement, the British are absolutely insistent there has to be an oath of allegiance to the king, or oath of fidelity, so forth. So if it doesn't matter, then why?
Why did it matter to the British signatories?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's an article that Joe Lee wrote where he makes a reference to the crown in the oath was reassuring to the, you know, millions of metaphysical monarchs. You know, that there was an element of irrationality, obviously, in people for whom the monarchical symbol was absolutely important and needed to be included in this settlement if it was going to be legitimate to the British.
It's the British get to say they didn't lose. You know, and if you read what the British generals and politicians say afterwards, they say, no, we didn't lose. We got the Irish to clean up the mess. You know, they put down the rebellion. Even, I think, Neville McCready said that. So, you know, it's important from this point of view of who gets to say who won and lost.
Yeah,
which might be irrational, but let's, you know, it's because war is irrational, you know.
Yeah, and I think there was, you know, face saving going on there as well.
Yeah.
You know, in the oath, I mean, there were plenty of people who said this is a pointless abstraction at the time. They were saying that, you know, but the oath is significant because it's a major, you know, symbolic kind of feature of any kind of constitutional arrangement that references who's the ultimate source of authority. And of course, a lot of attention, as you suggest, was put on to the wording of the oath, in which it was very careful to say allegiance to a constitution that references the crown, and the people debated the meaning of fidelity, and still historians to this day disagree about really what the allegiance was being declared to. Kevin O'Higgins argued passionately that it was only to the constitution, and ergo it wasn't truly a monarchical sort of oath. Others found that hair splitting and wouldn't accept it. But you know, I think the oath stands in as a bigger symbol of issues of sovereignty, issues of ultimately what was being fought for, and if they were willing to swallow the oath. And that phrase was used, you know, that people swallowed it. You know, if people were willing to do that, then, it begged questions about their original ideals and aspirations. So, you know, I think a lot of revolutionary movements, you know, reach a point like this, of, you know, having to consider settlements and having to consider what's an acceptable resolution, what can be compromised upon and what cannot be compromised upon. And I think that's featured there for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, the other issue surrounding the settlement of the Irish Revolution, which is a lot very much misunderstood, and is partition. Now, a very simple and vulgar, popular understanding says that the Civil War was about partition. And everybody who studies history in university says, no. Or learns, no, it wasn't about partition. Now, going back recently and reading the treaty debates on the local level up in the border area, the new border area, you see a lot of them were actually about partition. But that the anti-treaty had lost the argument because the Free State side said, we're also against partition. We're just going a different way. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, the specter of partition is, is a really complex issue. I mean, I think famously, I believe it was Maureen Wall who published something where, you know, she read through the treaty debates. This was before they would have been digitized and probably harder to paginate, whatever, but estimated, you know, that the incredibly small percentage of time that was actually spent on the partition aspects of the partition clause, the boundary commission clause, in reference to the North. And therefore, you know, I think that's kind of fed a perception that TDs on both sides of the treaty split essentially didn't really debate the, you know, the issue of partition.
Or didn't care about the North.
They didn't, that's the assumption. They didn't care about the North, that that they were implicitly partitionist or accepted it. I mean, there's a number of conclusions that can be drawn, but that and I've always wondered about that a little bit. I think I mean, there are, it is peppered through with references to partition, and I mean, one of the arguments is that, well, it wasn't discussed because people, both sides agreed that it was bad. Okay, so it wasn't as much of a point of contention. And B, that the supporters of the treaty assumed that the boundary commission arrangement would resolve it to the satisfaction of the free state. Also, we have to keep in mind that as bitter and as tendentious, you know, at times as the treaty debates were, there was still a moment even after the treaty debates when a lot of people were putting hope in the Constitution, and that the Constitution would square the circle and iron out the differences and produce a more Republican document than would, you know, than the treaty had. And of course, that became, you know, that didn't work out. Churchill sent it back and said, no, it has to fit with the terms of the treaty. Yeah, I would be hesitant to conclude the meaning of partition to the people of the time solely based upon the number of objective references to that issue in during, you know, the treaty debates themselves. Like you say, you'd have to look at the local level, particularly in the areas most affected. You'd have to look at local discourses and debates and discussions going on. Would be critical. There's a really, it's an interesting, you know, moment in you know, 1921, beginning of 1922. Those are the years from 1920 to the summer of 1922 when Belfast explodes with violence. Some people have called it, you know, the other Civil War. And
the pogrom is the
and then tens of thousands of Catholic nationalist refugees streaming over the border and coming to places in Dublin for assistance and going across into Derry, and, you know, it's a period of great chaos in the North, and a lot of attention was focused in the press in 1922 on, you know, what was going on in Craig's regime or Carsonia or, you know, that other various kind of pejorative terms for the new state. And what I've always been struck by is we step back now and historicize the conflict between the two sides in Sinn Féin as the Irish Civil War. But if you look at some of the newspaper coverage in 1921 and 1922, before it was clear that there was going to be serious violence between pro- and anti-treatyites, primarily in the South, if people talked about civil war in the newspapers, if the phrase was used, and if there was the assumption that there was going to be any civil war type conflict, it is assumed that it was going to be between the IRA and the Northern regime.
Right.
You know, a kind of a North-South unionist-nationalist conflict was the Civil War. So, I mean, all that is like a broader political military context. And I guess, you know, part of the challenge of writing, you know, histories of the period is it's a moment, as you say, you know, all students learn that the treaty didn't introduce partition. They, you know, they have to go back and the somewhat ironically titled Better Government of Ireland Act of 1920 produced the line of partition. It was already being reified and defended, and the northern state was up and running, you know, by the time the treaty was being debated. So for many people, it did seem like fait accompli. But at the same time, we also have, you know, in writing history, we also have to be aware that the line of partition is very new, and we have to kind of avoid sort of partitionist histories ourselves. I guess, yeah, I would be wary of simply kind of arriving at a conclusion about what partition meant to people at the time solely based upon the treaty debates. There's a lot more in terms of what was going on militarily, what was going on at the local level, I think, that would have to be brought into the equation.
From looking at the border area recently, particularly not the Donegal area, but the southern border area, if you like, is a very complex thing going on. But in the short term, politically, what you're seeing is that Collins and the Free State military, at least, the IRA people who side with Collins and side with the treaty, make the partition issue their own. And they arm the Northern IRA. They do this joint offensive with the anti-treaty IRA, so-called, which doesn't come off, on the North. And their people are all saying, oh, well, under the treaty, partition is a short-term thing. So in the short term, politically, they win the argument. And it's the idea that nobody cares about partition and that they're all, you know, they're all 26 county nationalists is reading it backwards. That's not the way. That's not just not the way it was at the time. I mean, maybe you can argue the sovereignty of the southern state is more important to them, which is understandable, but it clouds your vision. And again, as you're saying, there really sort of was another civil war in early 1922 along the border. Like they were firing back and forward every night. You know, the farmers are fleeing one side up, Catholics one side and Protestants the other side. As well as the pogrom, so-called, in Belfast, where Catholics were being killed. Catholics and Protestants were being killed. And again, we don't know what would have happened had the Southern Civil War not broken out. I'm very uncomfortable with this, with the kind of the new consensus that partition is nothing, is not important at the time.
But it's
true. It didn't cause the Southern Civil War, but it's not true. It's nothing to do with it either. I mean, Henderson, I think it is, who was arrested proud of the Forecourt's garrison.
Leo Henderson,
right? Which was one of the immediate sparks for bombing
the Forecourts.
Opening fire on the Forecourts. He was engaged in getting arms and funds to send to the north, and that's what he was doing at the time.
Yeah,
and supposedly they were cooperating with the other side. It's very kind of complex because there's lots of different people doing different things. But
sure. Yeah, and I know that other major figures, obviously, that would go on into the Free State Army were involved in clandestine northern campaign. I mean, Sean McKeown was involved in these efforts prior to taking up the Athlone command.
Yeah, Sean McKeown, Dan Hogan, Owen O'Duffy are basically central to this.
Yeah, and Owen O'Duffy as well, yeah. Yeah, and I take your point. I mean, you said it more eloquently than I did. I mean, essentially it's an issue of avoiding anachronism.
Yeah.
And just because we know later on that partition wasn't going to be moved by the Boundary Commission and that the status quo established by the 1920 Act, at least vis-a-vis the North, was somewhat carved in stone from that point, we can't go back to this highly fluid, highly complex, you know, moment of 1922 and assume that everything had the same fixity that it did, because it certainly did not. And
no.
I think it was very fluid. People had all kinds of perhaps aspirations and assumptions, and then, you know, history moved in a different direction and people's attentions were, I think, diverted. But that's the big counterfactual, of probably about 20 intriguing counterfactual questions to pose about the period. But as if IRA unity had been able to be maintained, and, you know, and that's what everybody who's active in the movement was trying to do, intensely over the spring, within the IRB and within the IRA, you know, what would have been the effects in terms, because there's no doubt in my mind that would have been more IRA activity turned against the North. I was doing a little research on the Free States nominees to the Senate. And famously, Arthur Griffith made something of a promise to the Anglo-Irish, Protestant community, that the Senate would be kind of a check on the more populist tendencies within, you know, electing members of the Dáil, and that the Anglo-Irish community would retain a voice in it. You know, and so that had a lot to do with the Senate picks. But interestingly, there was a nomination of a big Irish Parliamentary Party candidate, you know, one of these people who's sort of been eclipsed by the rise of Sinn Féin. I can't remember if it was William O'Brien or John Dillon, but it was somebody who was invited to take up the Senate, the position in the Senate. He declined, and in the course of declining, basically said, "I can't recognize the authority of your partitionists." And I've come across that a bit more. So sometimes one of the arguments that old parliamentarians made, that old members of the Home Rule who were subsequently pushed out of, pushed off the historical stage, so to speak, by Sinn Féin, they often argued that our solution would have not brought in partition, and yet you've brought in partition. So, you know, maybe one of the silences on the partitionist issue was that the Sinn Féin movement in general was also prey sometimes to these kinds of criticisms coming from the older nationalist leadership and nationalist home rule elite who said who assumed bitterly that their home rule settlement would not have been partitionist, you know?
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants this issue, don't they, in nationalist Ireland? But nobody wants to really do anything about it either. Like, one more thing to say about partition, from my point of view, is that while the Civil War is not about partition, and while both sides are anti-partitionist, one of the effects of the Civil War is that the Southern state becomes highly partitionist. And in 1923, the anti-treaty Republican candidates are arguing they're the only ones standing for United Ireland. And also, what you see as well, I think, at local level, is that the former Unionists become integrated into the Free State because of what they're not, you know? They're not Republicans, they're not irregulars. I think so that's kind of a result of the Civil War. The Free State didn't start out as a partitionist entity, but finished the Civil War as one, I would say.
And, you know, the other thing, regardless of the issue of partition itself, the dynamics of violence throughout the period are constantly crossing the imaginary line drawn by the 1920 Act, you know?
Yeah.
And so in really complex ways, you know, whether it's Leo Henderson in Dublin, I mean, I came across a number of threatening notices and threatening letters in Dublin and elsewhere that were basically inspired by acts of violence against Catholics in the North, and then were directed against Protestants, you know, threatening, you know, fairly low level stuff, mostly obviously threats and perhaps not acts of violence themselves. But nonetheless, you got a sense that people were paying attention to what was happening in the North and you know, occasionally feeling frustrated by it. So, you know, just little echoes of what was happening in the North are, you know, apparent through the Civil War, which is ostensibly not about the North that we're told sometimes. You know?
I got to get one more anecdote in on this before I move on. Up in Cavan. Where there wasn't an awful lot of Civil War violence, there had been, like, the IRA had been sort of massing there for this, whatever it was they were planning to do over the border in early 1922. And them and the specials were, the Ulster Special Constabulary were firing back and forwards every night, as I was saying. But when the Civil War broke out, and a lot of Cavan men joined the Free State Army, as they joined the British Army, you know, it's a poor county, people need jobs. Their casualties start coming back in the early stages of the Civil War. There was, you know, 8 or 10 come back in 1 week. And one of them was from just over the border in Fermanagh. And what's very interesting is that the specials, who they had been firing at previously, closed the roads and they presented arms and saluted as the coffin with the tricolour of the Free State soldier was taken to his, you know, to his home village for burial. Mm. So this is an interesting sort of symbol of the realignment of the two states. They've become an interest now, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's fascinating, yeah.
Whether any sense can be made of the Irish Civil War. And I think no sense can be made of it if we just look at it in isolation. I mean, the fact is that it came at the end of a revolution, we're calling it now, but certainly at the end of struggle for independence. And can some sense be made of the Irish Civil War as a stage of a revolution, the end of a revolution? In France, famously, they had the Thermidor, where Robespierre, who was the most radical of the Jacobins, was executed. From this, people have taken the generic term. For the end of a revolution, where the moderate revolutionaries put down the radical revolutionaries.
And the revolution needs its children.
Revolution needs its children. Can we see the Irish Civil War in this way?
Yeah, I mean, the that term, a Thermidor, has been used by, you know, participants in the period. I mean, I think Todd Andrews, you know, talks about the bourgeois Thermidor, and I think if he doesn't use the term, some of Ernie O'Malley's you know, later writings on the period kind of reflect on it. It is a similar kind of stage of reaction when, you know, certain members of the middle class or seen as more conservative figures within Irish society use this moment to consolidate their power and authority. So, I mean, that line of argument is associated with kind of a, you know, Republican socialist, kind of a left Republican tradition. Mm-hmm. But it actually seems to me have been fairly common in the Civil War as a kind of an argument that was posited. I mean, we famously associate some version of it with you know, the jail notes smuggled out of Mountjoy associated with Liam Mellows, but mm-hmm. probably written by a group of prisoners there, yeah. That kind of articulated aspects of the Republican socialist thesis about the conflict being a men of no property mm-hmm. versus a stake in the country people was the kind of the euphemisms used. And so there were people who believed that at the time. Mm-hmm. And obviously the Communist Party and, you know, mm-hmm. the Workers' Republic and were part of that discourse. And so in this view, then, I guess that begins to kind of blur then with the argument of a counter-revolution. Mm-hmm. There's certainly people who advance that argument, and I mean, John Regan's book uses the term and mm-hmm. In the title of his book, and there is a left Republican tradition that certainly sees it in that light. So, you know, that puts it in something of a comparative perspective, I guess, with mm-hmm. other revolutions that have ended violently, with the revolution turning in on itself. Mm-hmm. But that adds in kind of a class dimension, suggesting who were the counter-revolutionaries, and the argument is, you know, that it was the middle class, it was the stake in the country people. In general, I would argue, and it seems to be this would be the consensus, I think, that the Irish Civil War does not stand up to a strict, clear class, you know, conflict model. I mean, the lines of conflict are too blurred for that because, no. You know, Sinn Féin was a cross-class coalition. It's a classic nationalist movement. It needed the middle classes, and arguably had more lower and middle class folks than maybe people at either other ends of the social extreme. You know, so a split amongst those classes, it's harder to find a clear, you know, the proletariat lining up on one side and the forces and the bourgeois forces of reaction on the other. You know, so it defies such an easy model. You know, this bifurcation. But certainly, I'm interested. I think it's as important to respect and take seriously the perceptions that people had at the time, because they acted on those perceptions, and their animosities and their viewpoints were fueled by these perceptions. So I think it was a fairly widespread perception in, you know, Republican propaganda and the Republican press that everything that was happening under the Free State was a reaction against the revolution and was meant to consolidate power for a few people and not, you know. Yeah. So there's that argument that it fits that model. There's a famous quote that of Tolstoy's about, you know, all happy families are the same, and, you know, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, you know. And I kind of think that, like, in terms of a civil war, that while there's useful comparative models and interesting ways in which the Irish Revolution or its civil war phase can be compared and contrasted with other conflicts, at the end of the day, I think its dynamics are its own, are so local and specific to the... you know, to the terrain and landscape in Ireland, that, you know, it's fun to play with possible models, and, and but, you know, you can only go so far with them, you know. Putting aside the sort of Thermidor model, there's also the argument of, you know, the various phases of a revolution beyond that. And I was struck by the fact that there were some efforts during the Civil War, but also later. I remember reading some of the writings of Desmond Fitzgerald, who I believe he studied philosophy and taught philosophy, and, you know, and he was kind of waxing philosophical about the nature of, in the wake of the Civil War. And he and others have argued, kind of tried to, would appear to me to have taken some sort of comfort by trying to argue that civil wars are a natural part of the historical development of nations. And, you know, you could look to England with its civil wars, the United States with its great civil war, and we're at the 150th anniversary of right now, and that these are somehow a necessary stage of national development, and therefore Ireland had its civil war, and it somehow works out. I mean, I don't know, the argument might be that it somehow works out certain tensions and conflicts and within the nation, and that and the nation is stronger for having gone through this stage, you know. I mean, you know, it's an interesting theory, you know, that people posited at the time. Like I say, I think it was some way of making sense of the conflict and saying, and maybe pushing back against some of the rhetoric that was encountered from sort of Anglo-American sources that tried to look at the Civil War and say, look at this. You give Ireland independence and its chaos, misrule, inability to self-govern, you know. And I know that a lot of Irish American sort of commentators who saw the conflict, you know, from afar, reading about it in the papers, were horrified by it. And sometimes in their telegrams and in their letters to, you know, people in Ireland and in the press, where, you know, their attitude was, we have to stop this, you know, fratricidal conflict because it's living up to the worst stereotypes that, you know, of Irish self-government. So there's a conflict between taking some comfort that a civil war is a necessary stage of national development versus seeing the civil war as an example of some kind of uniquely Irish, you know, kind of inability to govern, you know?
Yeah, I mean, another way of making sense of the Civil War, both then and later, was to argue that it was a battle to uphold democracy, to uphold civilian rule against militarism.
Yeah, the Democrats and dictators. I think it's a term that John Regan uses.
Now, this is taking some flack recently, but there's certainly something in it, though, and because it's something that's repeated at the time a lot. I want to, again, give my little take on this, which I've noticed.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
One thing that's very interesting, though, right after the treaty is signed, before it's ever even debated in the Dáil, the pro-treaty line is that this is the will of the people, before they could have proven this in any way. You know, so, and it may well have been. I mean, people didn't want the black and tans back. They didn't want to return to chaos and warfare. So that's certainly plausible. But the pro-treaty line that it's the will of the people is there before it can ever be shown that it's the will of the people. On the other hand, the fact is that the IRA wasn't really accountable to civilian government, or only partially accountable during the War of Independence. And it becomes obviously much less accountable once it rejects the Dáil's approval of the treaty. So there is a case to be made that the Civil War is about bringing militarism under control. But the problem with this is that a load of the IRA, the senior IRA of the earlier period, is actually on the Free State side, and who are equally wedded to militarism as the ones on the other side. So if you talk about, like, the taming of militarism, I don't think you can confine it to only one side of the Civil War.
Because remember, there's
a mutiny right at the end of the Civil War by Free State soldiers, or threatened mutiny. You know, who did propose a coup very ineptly, but so that's my take, I guess.
It's a really big debate, and I mean, in terms of I think the argument that the war can be broken down into pro-treaty Democrats, anti-treaty militarists, you can find in lots, you know, in lots of histories of the Civil War, you know, particularly, you know, from the 80s and 90s, and you know, a lot of prominent historians have articulated some version of it. I think the work of Bill Kassane, the political scientist, and John Regan as well, I think were the two books that come to mind, the two authors who really pushed back hardest on this and have kind of really complicated that notion. And my reading of historiography now is that what had been the Democrats and dictators' consensus has now, because of Bill Kassane and John Regan and some others, has actually, is no longer the consensus. And a number of historians who had kind of used some really florid language and really pushed that interpretation hard have now softened it a little bit. And so instead of saying things like the anti-treaty IRA were undemocratic or anti-democratic, you know, there's a softening of language of maybe a-democratic or pre-democratic or, you know, democracy wasn't the issue in 1922-23. So there has been like a historiographical evolution there. Yeah, I would be inclined to disrupt that binary of Democrats and dictators, because it doesn't hold up from lots of different angles. And you pointed to a couple of them. There were militaristic tendencies within the Free State, unaccountable military actions and unaccountable sort of military culture in the Free State, although there were key moments when it was brought under civilian control, but many moments when it was well beyond civilian control, from the actions of the murder gangs and to the, you know, some of the unofficial executions. The case of Nola Mas comes to mind, where, you know, who was, you know, we know who was responsible, but the question was, what was the role of civilian government in this? And there's lots of questions about what were the civilian leaders, how were they implicated? And sometimes in the press, in inquiries at the time, they were named and implicated, but ultimately not held responsible. So it doesn't hold up in that particular sense, A. B, you can also see some of the statements of Free State leaders, people, if you read some of the memos and the reports of Owen O'Duffy, the commissioner of the Civic Guards, if you read some of the things that Kevin O'Higgins said and some of the things that his supporters said, people who wrote letters to him, there is a streak of support that was quite authoritarian. And I think somebody used a phrase that I think it might have been, I might misquote this, but I think it might have been in Ernest Blythe's witness statement, where, you know, basically if he'd been Kevin O'Higgins, he would have, you know, basically the equivalent of, we just, the country needed to be like boxed on the ears. Yeah. That, you know, the idea we need short, sharp shock, and that the country needs some authoritarian, you know, so this kind of language doesn't really fit with the stereotype of, you know, purist Democrats. No. Similarly, there were, the converse of this is that on the anti-treaty side, there were, you know, people like De Valera, who I think was quite frustrated throughout much of the Civil War at the failure of the military movement, the military side of the Republican movement to engage with the political side and have a proper political outlook in his mind. So there's tensions there. And then also, and this would be kind of what I think kind of along the lines of what Kassane and Regan sort of argue, if you make this argument, it doesn't, for the Democrats and dictators cleavage, if you go ahead then beyond the Civil War into the next 5, 10 year, 20 year period, it doesn't help at all to explain the subsequent political developments. How then, if the anti-treatyites were so incapable of, you know, were had this militaristic tendency in 1923, how is it that so many of them came into a, slightly constitutional party in 1926, but came into power and were able to exercise, maintain a significant political parliamentary sort of culture after 1932? And how is it that so many people associated with the Free State side then were flirting with at least a movement that had some of the trappings of European fascism? So it doesn't really hold up. So I think that at the end of the day, I think there was a real blurring of ideological tendencies and within both sides. Yeah. And I think you had people who were inclined to authoritarian, militaristic outlooks on both sides. You had people who were inclined to, you know, to legal, political, parliamentary, constitutional values on the other side. Adds to the blurring of the distinctions, that the easy reductive distinctions we can draw, you know, between the two sides.
Yeah, I mean, for once, I think in history, I think the truth is much simpler than it's sometimes given credit for, because I think that to be anti-democratic, you have to actually say, we don't want any more elections. We want to rule ourselves. We want to, you know. The anti-treatyites didn't say that. They didn't want that. I think what they wanted is fairly simple. You know, I think people have read too much into it. They had brought about the Republic. They'd sworn to uphold a Republic, and a Republic is what they wanted. You know, I think it's as simple as that. Now, okay, you can say they should have respected the civilian government, and I think it is an important moment that they don't get their way. But, you know, people who are anti-democratic are around in Europe. They're easy to find. You know, they're not concealing it. The fascists are marching in Rome towards the end of the Irish Civil War. So I think, you know, for once, I think it's much simpler than you can sometimes give them credit for.
Yeah. But that, you know, that point about the militarism, having said all, you know, all that I said, I mean, there were plenty of critics within the Republican movement who, I mean, you can read in Dorothy McArdle's history, you know, recognizes that she believed that there was kind of a a militaristic streak that got reinforced over the years that became problematic. And even, I think, Todd Andrews uses the phrase, it's a nice pun, gun mentality. So the gunman mentality that defines some of the some of the players in the period, for whom swaggering around with guns and solving problems with guns and not with debate was something that they had grown quite accustomed to. You know,
absolutely. So I think that's a slightly different question. I think that's an important part, but it's a slightly different question, though, because again, you find that on both sides. Like muzzling the guns, which is a phrase people used in 1923, is an issue that's not entirely the same as the will of the people issue. But I want to move on, because civil war in the end is about violence and killing, and that's why it's a civil war. So I think we, to be realistic and talk about what this was, we have to talk about that. Famously, as everyone knows, the civil war starts with the bombardment of the forecourts, and there's a short conventional phase where the ex-treaters basically do very badly and they're overwhelmed, and then there's, I think, the characteristic phase, and the reason why the civil war is remembered is the subsequent phase, though, which is of guerrilla warfare, but also anarchy, basically. Regarding violence in the Civil War, my question is, why is it so bad? Like, why do former friends and comrades kill each other over quite a protracted period? But the other question is, why is it not worse? Because most other civil wars have a much higher death toll.
Yeah, I mean, that's the paradox. I mean, you have to look at it from both sides. On the one hand, there's a tendency to talk about, well, we could even open that to the broader revolution more generally. You can make the claim that there's been far too much attention on the violence of the 1913 or 1916 to 1923 period. I mean, I remember, I think in the opening essay to his collection of essays, The IRA at War, you know, Peter Hart lists kind of bullet points, a number of questions that kind of motivate some of his researches. And one of them was, you know, why was the Irish Revolution so violent? But, you know, I think the question is, was it? It wasn't
for an armed conflict. No.
Yeah, I mean, and especially if you put it in, whether you put it in the context of the broader the passage of Irish history, you know, a fraction of the people died in the Irish Revolution as died in the 1798 Rising. The Battle of Aughrim was more violent in one day than the Irish Revolution was over maybe 10 years. You know, so in that sense, it's not even a particularly violent period in the broad swath of Irish history. And then, as you say, if you put it in comparative context with other civil wars, the American Civil War, and even taking into account, obviously, different the proportion of population, at the end of the day, was not a particularly violent period. Now, so the first point is, it wasn't all that violent, you know.
Comparatively.
Yeah. Whether in, you know, looking with, across time in the Irish context, or just comparing it to other civil wars. Elsewhere. Having said that, we also have to, you know, obviously be attentive to the degree of violence that was there, the intimate nature of the violence, the state executions, the assassinations, the sort of unattributed killings that, you know, both sides were mixed up in. And if you follow the newspapers and just pay attention to the details of individual killings, I mean, it's hard to not walk away and be, you know, shaken somewhat by the level of violence. Some really gruesome things were done by people on both sides. Some are infamous, you know, from, you know, Ballyseedy, for example. And certain assassinations, Sean Hales or Michael Collins, you know, killed on the Free State side. Others, you know, tend to not be known except by people who are, you know, going into really detailed research. So, yeah, that's a question. Why was the Civil War... Why did it take on the dynamics that it took on? Like you were saying, the standard narrative, and, you know, it breaks down pretty clearly, is that there was a conventional phase and then followed by a guerrilla war phase. It's pretty heavy fighting in the conventional phase, and sea landings and artillery bombardments, and, you know, it looks like a real honest to God war. After that, it really breaks down into a guerrilla conflict, which was still relatively low scale, and also not a classic guerrilla conflict in the sense that it was quite regionally sporadic, and it didn't kind of achieve all that it wanted to achieve. And you can make not to go too far into counterfactuals, but, you know, there was talk of the anti-treaty side getting their own, you know, more of their own artillery, one of these mountain guns or something that where they would have been able to fire onto towns from the hills. And, you know, obviously if some of these weapons and arms had been procured, then maybe it could have been more violent. Some of the violence, so I guess my focus of my research is not military history per se, so I'm not an expert on military hardware, but... you know, there were some developments that shaped the nature of violence. I mean, I understand that use of trap mines and use of mines became more common and was quite more sophisticated, more complex by the Civil War phase. And so that begins to obviously shape violence. So the mining of barricades, and then when they're moved by government soldiers, people are killed. And then, you know, obviously the atrocities in Kerry, that was sort of a grim response to that as well. So you can, you know, some of it is attributable to that. A lot of it obviously has a very intimate dynamic of people being abducted and murdered, and no one ever held accountable. It begs questions about the motives of those acts of violence. Obviously political, but, you know, what is the euphemism or cliche that's always used? The settling of old scores, you know. Yeah. So there the causes of violence, the motives of violence are very, very unclear, and the dynamics are very, very complex. The nature of the violence ultimately was much more probably, you know, that's this face-to-face kind of violence, not the large-scale, not the large-scale kind of military conflict that it appeared to have that dynamic at the very opening stages of the war.
But this is a pretty passing phase, though.
It's a very short-lived phase, and as you say, the Free State very quickly achieves, I guess you could say, you know, military hegemony in the field in terms of its ability to hold towns, major population centers. So after that, you know, maybe that has something to do. Now, there have been arguments about, this speaks a little bit to the geography of violence in the Civil War. You know, people have been interested for a long time in both the continuities, but also the discontinuities in the violence from the War of Independence, you know, from the 1919-21 phase against Crown forces to the Civil War phase. And it would appear that, so the classic example is that, you know, County Kerry became significantly more violent over the course of the Revolution and was a major theater in 22 and 23, more so than it had been in the earlier phases. So, and that's a really interesting question, why that was the case. And then why also was Kerry the site of some of the worst, you know, the tragedies of Kerry, the worst. And so, you know, there have been different explanations posed for that about the bringing in of Free State troops from outside, from Dublin, and some northern volunteers who were brought into the Free State Army. Is there, I'm inclined to think that there were some tensions between urban-based soldiers and their reaction to being in rural areas, and maybe some that urban-rural divide maybe manifested itself in some of the animosities. That might be part of the explanation. But then again, that would assume that there would be greater violence in all areas that were rural, and that's not necessarily the case.
There's kind of three strands of violence, if you like. There's the strictly military thing, about who wins and who loses. Now, one thing which struck me recently, which I don't think has given enough attention, is that the anti-treaty side simply could not have won in a military sense. Why? Because the British are still in Ireland. You know, there's 6,000 troops and artillery, and they're ready to send as many more back in whenever they need them. So the anti-treatyites winning in a conventional military sense is simply not going to happen. Like, for example, when Frank Aiken takes Dundalk in August 1922 in one of the more accomplished anti-treatyite actions of the Civil War, people say, well, why didn't he march on Dublin? I mean, this is a complete fantasy. There's 6,000 British troops equipped with heavy artillery and armoured cars and whatever they want in the way, you know? And Frank Aiken has maybe 200-300 guys, you know, with small arms. So from a military point of view, the result is a foregone conclusion, you know? And I don't think people appreciate this enough. So, in a way, and people also say, well, why didn't Liam Lynch coordinate strategy better now? Number one, okay, he was very bad at this. The anti-treatyites were exceptionally bad from a military point of view. They were unable to coordinate things. People didn't do what they were told. They wouldn't follow orders, which is normal for a guerrilla army anyway. But they were really bad, generally, their performance from a military point of view. But the point is, what Liam Lynch tries to do, which is a low-intensity campaign, you attack the infrastructure, you bring down the government, was a realistic strategy. Under the circumstances. A conventional warfare strategy was not realistic. And early O'Malley actually didn't grasp this, I don't think, or didn't grasp it enough, that actually it is a rational strategy in a kind of way. Maybe it's not, but it's a rational short-term strategy. I think we need to talk even in more detail about the sort of atrocities and revenge killings, but a really large amount of Free State reprisals are carried out by former IRA people. I think there's, you know, so a lot is made of the former British Army elements in the Free State Army, which were there, but generally, they didn't get too emotionally involved, I don't think, you know? Whereas when a former IRA guy on the Free State side is killed, there's revenge taken. And almost all of the atrocities on the Free State side can be traced back to one of their people, you know?
Many members of the squad were implicated.
A squad person particularly being killed. And in Kerry, the Ballyseedy thing was sparked by a guy, Stapleton, who was a former squad man or intelligence officer man, being blown up with the mine at Nagnagashal. So it's very personal.
Right. And then Paddy O'Daly, who was a member of Dublin Active Service Unit, was implicated in a lot of the violence there. So much of it can be traced
to specific people, again. And I mean, I got into trouble for saying this before, but it's a fact that Charlie Dalton, who was actually not technically a squad member, he was an intelligence officer under Michael Collins. But again, he's responsible, or alleged to be responsible, for a whole load of clandestine assassinations or murders, let's call them that, in Dublin, of people who were abducted and
including
killed.
The three boys we were discussing.
Yeah, so three boys dumped out in the Red Cow, and I don't know if Dalton, I shouldn't say he was, but three more boys dumped up in Whitehall, and I say boys because that's what they were teenagers.
Late teens.
Yeah. And there was also, you know, the total is about 29 Republicans who were basically picked up and assassinated in Dublin. It goes back to questions of, you know, swaggering around with guns and using guns to solve problems, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think as well, we should talk about executions as well, but the government has got off a bit lightly, I'm afraid, on this, because reading through Ernest Blyde's witness statement, it's very clear there was a squad of gunmen in the CIA, the Criminal Investigation Department, who were also in this thing called the Protective Corps and so forth, working with Cosgrave, who really were working for him directly, and who were also involved in assassinations. Whether Cosgrave was ordering them or not, he certainly knew what they were up to, I think.
Yeah, I think the relationship between CID, Oriel House Gang, and Free State Army Intelligence, and some of these other players who are implicated in these extrajudicial killings, the relationship between them and civilian authorities is very unclear. And I think oftentimes, though, the civilian authorities get off in historical accounts because we assume that they weren't really implicated in it. I was just struck by newspaper coverage that was talking about at the end of the Civil War, the demobilization of the CID.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating because the newspapers, Freeman's Journal and a number of other accounts, stressed the grand work that the CID had done under difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
And they talked about the head of the CID as this man of many talents. I think he did a magic trick, among other skills. And it was really emphasis on the administrative abilities of this group and how that the citizens of Dublin appreciated all their hard work. And it was really a refusal to obviously at that moment to engage at all with the numerous murders and in custody torturing and all the other things that and the argument that was posited was that the CID was made up respectable, very skilled intelligence officers who had a fearsome reputation amongst Republicans, and that's all that they needed was this fearsome reputation to get any prisoner to gush forth all of the facts. So they really completely allied and avoid engaging with the violence that was part and parcel of the CID's modus operandi. So there's that issue. So I think that the role of civilian authorities in allowing that to occur, or even in some cases being directly implicated in these acts of violence, is maybe not fully known, but also perhaps understated. You know, that issue of the dynamics of violence. The other thing I've always been intrigued by is, you know, you say, well, why was the nature of violence the way it was? Quite low level comparatively, but with some quite brutal killings. If you go to kind of the post-mortem analyses that, you know, Republicans did on the conflict in the wake of, in their memoirs and years later, the kind of things that tend to get stressed, there's a kind of a recurrent phrase, a recurrent outlook that kind of says our heart wasn't in it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a tendency to say that, and that speaks to a point that we haven't mentioned yet, but, of course, the vast majority of people who had been active in the War of Independence in the field or, you know, in some capacity in the IRA technically were neutral in the Civil War, as I understand it. The numbers aren't, maybe perhaps not the vast majority, but there were tens of thousands of people who had some claim to involvement in the volunteers, some kind of support role, who simply didn't take part in it. And, you know, the neutral IRA was active in peace moves and active in trying to maintain unity. So a lot of people didn't take part in it who had been very active in the War of Independence. That itself, I think, is a really important point. And then those who did, the sense you get is there is a level of reluctance.
Yeah.
And so their heart wasn't in it. Maybe they didn't feel they had a divided community, may have made it difficult to operate. But it also meant that it was difficult to maybe justify one's actions. I don't know, that could have been part of it. They oftentimes also point to inability to take prisoners. Although, you know, that one has always struck me as odd because there was an inability to take prisoners for the most part during the War of Independence as well.
They shot more, though. They used to shoot more British soldiers when they captured them, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And there were famous instances of taking, a general or officer hostage here and there.
Yeah.
But you know, there's that argument. And of course, one of the things, you know, the opposite of all these are the advantages that the Free State had. And as you pointed out, well, there were thousands of troops, of British troops.
Yeah, up to December.
Up to December.
But ready at any point.
Yeah, yeah. And as was pointed out, I think it was Margaret Pierce in the Dáil during the treaty debates pointed out that the evacuation of British troops, which was being used as an argument for support of the treaty, as well as the return of all these prisoners, she pointed out, well, where will they go, I wonder? Or somebody, and basically across, if they were across the border, they could easily be mobilized. So there's that point. Yeah. But I think, but the other point is that the Free State had access to a massive, you know, essentially prison complex. And so, I mean, the list of facilities in which Republicans were held, from the massive, you know, Tin Town camps, you know, in the Curra, to smaller jails, you know, in every Irish rural town, in Kilmainham here and Mountjoy. I mean, a huge number of facilities, and the exact numbers of Republicans interned has always been, you know, somewhat debated. You get figures as low as 10 or 11,000, and you get figures as high as 18, 19, 20,000, you know. And at the end of the Civil War, perhaps as many as 15,000 were still being held when the war ostensibly is ended, has been declared as, you know, essentially over by the Free State, enough to have an election in August 1923, and yet you have, you know, well over 10,000 prisoners. So I think the ability to bring in and imprison, in, essentially at that point, indefinitely, thousands and thousands of Republican activists, be they, you know, soldiers or supporters, and of course, and hundreds and thousands of Kumandaman and female activists as well. So really, I think that that was a significant advantage, and that probably had something, a significant impact on the progress of the conflict.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, what those figures, again, which are the only figures of the Irish Civil War which are very high, you know, absolutely speaking, show you again is the nature of the conflict. I mean, it was what the British Army used to call a police action, for the most part. And the Free State, actually, Free State side, or pro-treaty side, I should say, would emphasize this, that the irregulars gave up. They didn't fight to the last man, that they, when they were surrounded, they dropped their arms and put up their hands. I mean, Ernest Blythe said in 1923, in an election rally up in Monaghan, that except for one or two cases in Kerry, they didn't fight a man's fight at all, or something like that, you know? So it was part of the sort of derision of the Free State side that they weren't real soldiers, the irregulars, they were playing at soldiers. But, I mean, I guess in terms of, if we look at again how bad this was and what kind of conflict it was, you were much more likely to be arrested and imprisoned than you were to be killed as a guerrilla.
Yeah, yeah. And internment was a major and very effective tool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with the public safety laws that were passed, I mean, basically, people could be held indefinitely. And so even though Republicans dumped arms in spring of 1923, there were no significant releases throughout the summer. Then that's the surreal thing to me has always been the August 1923 election, which, you know, is used by historians to kind of assess the general levels of support. And, you know, one of the conclusions is that there was a significant amount of support for Sinn Féin, so the anti-treaty party, in the election. But still, that level of support was you know, eclipsed by pro-treaty parties. But it's always seemed to me that it's not, I would be hesitant to look at that election and, of course, the summer of 1922, so-called PACT election, to look at either of them as a particularly accurate reflection of the levels of public support. Because in the case of the 1923 election, it was a highly, you know, irregular election, in which you had tens of thousands or many thousands of Republicans still interned. You had army and soldiers and plainclothes police watching the polls. Yeah. There was a feeling of, I think, of menace and state coercion involved in there. Mm-hmm. So really, and this actually begs the question of when the Civil War ends, you know, but that it's that paradox in the end of the summer of 1923, you have literally the Free State proclaiming business as usual with an exercise in democracy, you know, an election. Yet at the same time, you have highly unusual circumstances, you know, still in existence, mass internment. And of course, there's still some of the, you know, handful of extrajudicial killings and then some of the chaos that begins to emerge. In a case, it might be too strong a word, but the problems that are arising from demobilizing Free State soldiers in a tough economy, there's not a lot of jobs, and there's some implication that Free State soldiers are making overtures to the IRA and vice versa. You have lots of IRA activists who are out on the run, who see it as a highly dangerous time and are desperate not to be caught. So, you know, it's a really complex sort of fluid moment. But I think that persistence of internment for so long in the wake of the Civil War was both I think, a great cause of bitterness at the end of the conflict, and in some ways in, almost as important, if maybe a more important dynamic than the violence itself. But I think that's a very significant advantage that the state has, has all of these sort of advantages, a central state authority. Yeah. So that, I think, in that sense, it was a very uneven conflict, and that might have something to do with the poor performance of the anti-treaty IRA, as you suggest.
Just before we leave the violence, there's two more things I want to touch on, and one of them is obviously the executions, which are a very famous motif of the Civil War. Famously, the Republican number is 77, although it's actually about 81, I believe.
Yeah.
The sure number. One thing that struck me when you look at the actual time of the executions is how shocked everybody is by this hard-edged approach. And also, one of the things, again, which you see on the ground, like up in Dundalk, they shot two people in the late 1922, November, December, I forget which. But there was crowds saying the rosary outside, which is a traditional sort of thing by that point. It's what had been done for Kevin Barry and for people hanged by the British, and they get fired on. And the same thing happens here on O'Connell Street in Dublin. So the executions are certainly, actually the number is, again, it's not huge in comparative terms, but are certainly emotionally a very shocking policy.
Yeah, I mean, the executions are regularly, sort of referenced as perhaps one of the most significant aspects of the Irish Civil War, one of the things that is most difficult to sort of reconcile, both with, you know, this argument about Democrats and dictators. The executions have to be factored into that. But also in terms of, you know, how could this first arguably sort of native Irish government, the first one in sort of history, carry out more executions in just 10 months as far more than the British had carried out in the preceding years. And so, yeah, I think, I mean, one of the arguments is that, well, there's the question of were the executions ultimately efficacious in demoralizing the Republican movement and breaking the back of that? And, I think many people conclude that ultimately they were.
Yeah.
You know, ironically, the very early executions tended to generate an enormous amount of, you know, public revulsion. I mean, most famously, the execution of Erskine Childers in November of 1922. There's a whole pile of telegrams that flooded into the new government saying, some said, go do this. This man is a traitor, or, you know, he deserves it. Others said, don't do this. And many of them were saying, if you carry out this act, you know, you'll be no worse than the British government you've replaced, or if you carry out this act, you'll lose all legitimacy. So there was a real kind of revulsion there, and I think one of the phrases somebody used in protesting against the executions was that basically every execution is sort of a nail hammered in the coffin of the Free State. Mm-hmm. That with each execution they lose legitimacy, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, ironically, historically, it seems that wasn't the case, that with each execution, there seems to have been ultimately sort of a public exhaustion. Yeah. I don't know, people use that phrase, compassion fatigue, when they talk about the English response to the Great Famine. I wonder, there is a level of compassion fatigue where the killings on both sides and the executions and all the different commands ultimately didn't generate, generated, a fair amount of, you can find petitions and you can find Sinn Féin controlled, county councils and local bodies that protest against them. But you have people pushing back in those contexts as well and arguing that they shouldn't be debating this. I think that it's frustration over the fact that there wasn't a mass public disapproval of the executions culminated in the IRA's March 1923 effort to ban the holding of public amusements,
Yes,
and
yes.
if you read the sort of communique, the manifesto, if you will, that was published sort of announcing that, the argument was, it's March 1923. It's the period of these significant acts of violence in Kerry. Mm-hmm. And also numerous executions have been carried out and continuing to be carried out. And so the IRA says, with thousands of Republicans suffering in the internment camps and being killed in the field and being executed, that people shouldn't be out enjoying movies and attending races. And so there was a failed effort to prevent the holding of public amusements, including young men in trench coats going around to the local theaters in Dublin and stopping and there's this small acts of violence committed around that. Again, it wasn't very successful, and I think it speaks to the fact that by 1923. By the end of, towards the end of the Civil War, I think a lot of people were tired of revolution and had just sort of accepted the inevitability of the executions. That's a really profound issue to contemplate, how the executions carried out earlier could cause such, famously the 1916 executions, change things utterly, although we know that to be somewhat of a reductive interpretation of it. But nonetheless, when the British carried out executions, it tended to backfire. Mm-hmm. And yet when the Free State did it, while there were certainly voices of protest against it and certainly deeply embittering to Republicans, it doesn't seem to have generated a really significant mass revulsion enough to have stopped the policy, you know.
Yeah,
and it was carried on even into the end of the Civil War, when the anti-treaty campaign was clearly nearly crippled. There were still executions carried out.
Yeah, I mean, one aspect of the executions is that people, particularly Patrick Hogan, the Minister for Agriculture, Kevin O'Higgins, the Minister for Justice, argued to us, this is the only way to show the iron hand of the law. You know, these people have no respect for law and order. As you said before, they characterize them as hooligans, as wreckers, the odd one idealist, but most of them, you know, young boys who don't know any better, and this will kind of knock some sense into them. And this, I think, this kind of explains the remorselessness of it. But I have to say, without agreeing with them necessarily, they did work, I think, the executions. They used enough terror, which the British never really did, in order to put down a guerrilla insurrection. I think this is probably how you do it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that phrase was used at the time. It was basically, it was state counter-terror, using methods of terror. And I think that's why the carrying out of the executions, you know, it was exported, you know, so it needed to be in every
county.
Military command,
that's
every
right.
county. And in fact, most of the frustration was coming from general headquarters and Mulcahy, was that the failure of certain commands to carry out executions.
That's right.
And the hesitance of some troops to carry them out. And so there was really kind of a frustration that sometimes the army wasn't adequately carrying out this, you know, the extreme punishment that the state... So, and actually that speaks to this, I don't always get back to the Democrats and dictators things, but there is a really interesting kind of factor in the Civil War, in that at times it seems that certain figures that we think of as, you know, that were civilians, and we think of as some more pacific, constitutional, democratic forces who aren't technically in the army, are sometimes the voices of more remorseless violence, you know? I mean, at the early stages of before the Civil War broke out, as I understand it, you know, Collins was quite hesitant to engage in open conflict, and was, of course, you know, famously involved in all kinds of backroom and, you know, efforts at forging relationships and keeping the unity. It was Griffith that was pushing very hard for, you know, taking military action against the anti-treatyites early on to sort of, you know, prevent it from the conflict from escalating. And similarly, Kevin O'Higgins is often perceived, often quite inaccurately, as the main voice of the executions, even though, you know, I think it was because he later on rhetorically defended the
That's
executions
right. yeah.
publicly,
yeah.
Quite eloquently and very forcefully. You know, we've executed 77 and we'll execute 777 more, you know, but it wasn't so much that he was personally more implicated in the policy than any of the other members of the cabinet. But I think he, once they committed to it with a sort of grim logic, and they used logic, you know, they kind of gave historical examples, Abraham Lincoln using extreme measures in the American Civil War, that the state has the right to carry out these extreme punishments in the case of dealing with a militant minority who's not respecting the will of the majority. These were the arguments that were mobilized, and therefore, if you follow that logic, then the executions of even hundreds of Republicans could be rationalized. But yeah, I've always been struck by the kind of the ferocity at times of some of the civilian leaders, whereas you find elements and examples of this hesitance and reluctance within the military commands themselves.
No, completely. I mean, there's one reason for that, I think, is in people who are involved in warfare know that this is a reciprocal thing, that if you kill your prisoners, they'll kill theirs. So that's one reason. But another thing that strikes me about the executions, though, and the comparison that's always made between the Free State and the British pre-1921, the British only executed officially 20 or so, is that the British actually had plans to massively up executions at the time of the truce. So what the Free State did may have been just a taste of what the British would have done had they really got round to putting down in a ruthless way the IRA campaign. But I want to move on from that to talk about the Republican violence. And we said before, some of this is characterized by military means, by ambushes, by use of mines, which they get better at, attacks on barracks, although they're not so good at that by the end. They can't get so many people together. But a lot of it is destruction of property, burning people's houses, and attacks on, as you said, on public entertainment, which is, I just came across recently. And a Dublin IRA volunteer died on O'Connell Street trying to blow up a cinema.
And there was also an effort on the big boxing match at La Scala, the Siki McTeague, which caused some damage. But it's a really interesting campaign.
But a lot of Republican violence is like that. It's low level, it's destruction of property, it's attacks on civilians, actually, famously burning of people's houses.
No.
So they don't come out of it very well from that point of view either.
Yeah, the level of destruction of the Civil War is massive. I can't recall off the top of my head the official monetary figure placed on the amount of damage, but you have to consider there were attacks on the transportation system and attacks on public buildings and, you know, courthouses, and then there were attacks on private properties, and, you know, most notoriously, the big houses of, you know, the Anglo-Irish elites, which mm-hmm. were, you know, burned in their dozens in the period. Yeah. And then, you know, at massive, you know, cost, no doubt. And then many other smaller acts of violence, and including, and some of that blurs with some of the labor strife, particularly yeah. in Waterford, mm-hmm. where there's an agricultural laborer strike. There are all kinds of arson attacks that would be very difficult to attribute. In some cases, might have been attributed to the anti-treaty IRA, or what more likely to have been said in the police reports, irregularism.
Yeah.
But
which just means anarchy as far as the authorities are concerned.
Exactly. It's kind of a catch-all term for yeah. forces against the state. A lot of it, I remember, I found so many references to hay being burned. Mm-hmm. I mean, it must have in 1923, there must have been some, you know, millions of, you know, of pounds in weight of hay destroyed. So really, you know, you wonder if that's maybe an example. All the use of, you know, of fire, of arson. And I know that there's a historian that's recently written about arson as a tactic in the period. I mean, I wonder if that's simply an easier tactic for a guerrilla army that not capable at a later stage of occupying towns and not in a position to attack, you know, well-defended, well-reinforced barracks, and so the burning of private property. It's kind of often usually non-lethal form of violence, although obviously in some instances, you know, people were killed.
Yeah. Kevin O'Hagan's father, for example, is shot in during a burning, I think.
Well, his house was raided in Portlaoise, and mm-hmm. then there's some dispute as to the instance and to the circumstances of the shooting, whether he was attempting to grab a revolver from one of the raiders, whether he was himself pulling out a revolver. I've also heard that he was pulling out a piece of paper given to him by the local IRA commander, basically saying, leave him alone. Some of the burnings were obviously against members of the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so the big houses and members of the Dáil and the Senate, their houses were targeted. In some cases, there were houses that were targeted, burned, because there was a connection with some figure in the Northern Irish regime, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that might be attack against a local unionist, but there were oftentimes a direct tie to a member of the Northern Irish Assembly or the yeah. Carson government.
That's right.
So there's those inspired that way. Obviously, some of it is, though, on a smaller scale, would be agrarian violence.
That's right.
And be very difficult to discern exactly who the perpetrators were and the exact motive, but clearly there might have been. So I think maybe when you're putting your finger on, when you look at the scale of the destruction and that there's a lot of factors that are kind of overlapping and contributing to that. Some of it's obviously very political. Some of it might reflect the military, the guerrilla tactics of the anti-treaty IRA and their failure to maybe engage in other forms of violence more effectively. And some of it is also the fact that at this, by 1923, you've got a blurring of anti-treaty opposition to the Free State government with general anti-state activism of some kind, which could be everybody, people who don't want to pay taxes,
yep.
to people who are trying to settle old scores and frustration over previous loss of land and are trying to get back land. Mm-hmm. That goes back 34, you know, several generations. Mm-hmm. You have even instances in some counties and the counties Leitrim and elsewhere where mm-hmm. there are armed Pachin. People involved in the Pachin trade, distillers yeah. who actually have armed themselves and yeah. have fairly sophisticated operations where they're dealing with the emergent Gardaí, you know, the civic guards
sure.
who are, and the Special Infantry Corps, which is yeah. really the materials within the Special Infantry Corps offer a great window on to this blurring of motives here, because they're sent out to Waterford to deal with the agricultural laborers, they're sent out west to deal with agrarian conflict, and they're also dealing with anti-treaty violence. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think that the massive destruction in the Civil War, I think, is reflective of really the blurring of lots of motives and lots of different kinds of conflicts.
I think this is a really important thing for people to know when they think about the Irish Civil War and remember it, that it was remembered as such a bad time, not only for the conflict, military conflict, but because it was such a time of anarchy. And I have a couple of anecdotes which I like about this. Like in Dublin, if you read carefully through the Ernie O'Malley Civil War papers, which have been published by Cormac O'Malley and Andol, you see the Dublin IRA Active Service Unit, anti-treaty, of course, was stood down in the autumn of 1922 because it was getting too involved with the criminal gang who were not affiliated with the anti-treaty IRA. They were knocking off too many banks and not doing anything else, you know. So, and up in Cavan Monaghan area, you see a lot of shootings. One shooting, for example, is actually just before the Civil War, is of a foreman who was during a strike, who was too hard on the workers, the road workers, as the road workers were constantly in dispute with the council over whether the council would employ them directly or whether there'd be a contractor. But a foreman is shot over that. Maybe the guy was in the IRA who shot him, maybe he wasn't, you know. Again, as you said, people who were evicted going back to the land war 70 years before are getting up in court and saying that they felt that they were entitled to the land now that the British were gone, and they were shooting at the person who was there, be they whatever political colour. So a lot of the violence is very difficult to just distinguish. And again, so when the Free State government talk about anarchy and stuff, they have a point to some degree.
Yeah, yeah, and it's very difficult to compartmentalize a lot of the violence, and there's multiple motives, maybe. So what I was thinking about, we were kind of bringing it back to your point about the different phases of revolution, struck me that, and actually this argument is kind of posited at the time by some commentators, that during the War of Independence, obviously there's a very significant effort on the part of Sinn Féin, the so-called Republican shadow government or counter-state, to supplant the British government. And it does so in really effective ways. At the propaganda level, it's very successful. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's very successful in some ways in terms of raising money, taking over local government bodies, local administration. And then there's the Sinn Féin courts. And there's lots of good examples of it. But, of course, at the end of the day, they couldn't carry out all the functions of a central state because they couldn't collect taxes.
Well, only very regularly.
Yeah. Very irregularly. Kind of right, yeah. Very regularly. Now, there were funds that were transferred into Sinn Féin. But for the most part, it was very easy in that period for people to probably avoid paying all their taxes, and even having a patriotic motive in refusing to do so. You know, of course, many of the major figures in the Sinn Féin administration were, you know, on the run, being hunted down and killed and liable to that. So you have a period, I think, where there is something of a vacuum for quite a long time, where the British state has lost legitimacy and can't function beyond, you know, kind of martial law and kind of coercive tactics. People aren't, you know, that, I mean, the best example of that is how ordinary sort of lawyers are now arguing their cases before Sinn Féin courts. You know, is it a great example? And that people would attend those and accept their rulings is a great sign of the legitimacy accorded to them. But still, in that period, it was not settled enough for Sinn Féin government to really carry out all the normal functions of government. So that situation lasted for quite a long time. And then in 1922, you have a section of the movement and considerable section of the population saying, okay, we accept the legitimacy of this new state. And it's fascinating. There's literally a moment when many people who support the treaty say, okay, from this moment on, December 6th, 1922, when the Free State formally comes into existence or with the majority count vote on the treaty, say from this moment on that you owe the state your legitimacy, mm-hmm. and the authority of the state reigns supreme. And so actions that were carried out just moments before, which could be seen as patriotic, resistance to colonial authority, are now acts of sort of treason and resistance to the lawfully created state. And so it's fascinating that moment when this divide is created. And of course, not everybody accepts it. And so I think a lot of what the Free State is dealing with are people who are, yes, politically motivated to resist that state. But then they're also dealing with people who have, I think, a longstanding tradition, this most recent period of political uncertainty, who are just simply not recognizing any state authority. And so the state really has to kind of assert itself. And in the space in that vacuum, then all kinds of sort of conflict and all kinds of violence kind of arise. So a lot of it has to do with, I think, the whole question of central state authority in Ireland. And I think for so long, obviously, the central state authority was not bestowed with legitimacy for huge sections of the population. And so, it's difficult then for being, against the government has a certain patriotic
quality. Well, it still does.
Quality. Yeah.
But yeah. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. But I think that the one really important aspect of this, which is also important if we talk about revolutionary process and its origins and its results, is the land question. And it's often missed how important this is. I think there's a parallel to be made with partition. Because, like partition, the land question is a very traditional central plank of nationalist politics. And like partition, in 1922-23, the Free State side win the argument. They say that we're in the side of the farmer, we're going to bring in the land bill. And they do. They bring in a land act which compulsorily purchases the remaining traditional landed estates. And what Fianna Fáil and the anti-treaty Heights do later is that they build up a base on the people who don't benefit from that.
Right.
But I think this is, you know, this is not appreciated how important this is, because it seems foreign to us in our post-rural, you know, urbanized age. But, you know, I think this is the absolute center of what's happening, you know?
Yeah, the question about the land question and its role in the revolution has obviously been debated for a long time. And there was a tendency for people to dismiss it altogether. And, you know, the simplistic narrative was that the land question was solved through the acquisition of peasant proprietorship in the late 19th century, which was a great administratively or parliamentary, you know, kind of social revolution. And, you know, and as a result, it's been argued, I mean, I think that Paul Bew and some others have basically said you could not have a significant social revolution in Ireland in 1916 because it would have to be based upon the land. Sinn Féin movement cut across the haves and the have-nots, or the, and you had peasant proprietors, and you know, it was a key base. Ergo, the land question wasn't relevant. But that's too simplistic. That's too simplistic because if you look at the nature of violence in the War of Independence too, and in the Civil War, obviously the land question arises, and obviously that's clearer the more you look at the local level. And it's the reason you know that the Sinn Féin courts were established in the first place. Arbitration courts were there to contend with violence around the land in Galway and parts of the West. And you know, famously, of course, it's been argued that they that those courts were there to prevent the specter of social revolution, and that the first case is supposedly, you know, was done in favor of the landlord or done in favor of the landed interest. But I mean, I think that there are lots of examples in terms of the dynamic of violence that the land question mattered, and I think it shaped people's aspirations certainly. And I especially think, and my argument would be that even if the land question was quite volatile and quite polarizing during the War of Independence, and that would be an argument for certain you know, local IRA commanders to try to prevent and suppress any kind of violence you know, around the land, any kind of agrarian discontent, that same argument would suggest that you there could be quite a lot of it after 1922 when the IRA split, because the you know, the IRA has split now. So obviously there would be, there's a benefit to the anti-treaty IRA associating itself with a certain amount of agrarian discontents, because that would just further stretch the resources of the Free State. It would add to the general sort of chaos and unmanageable nature of the conflict. And it also is, as you know, as Liam Mello said in the jail notes, you know, we're back to the men of property. That would suggest that there would be a way of linking up social discontents, which would primarily be around the land, you know, in this period, and the Republican cause. That link-up perhaps didn't quite happen in terms of a direct connection between Republican political policy in the period and you know, military policy and the land question, but in more furtive, chaotic ways, there was a symbiosis that anti-treaty action in a given area could create an opportunity for agrarian actions, and agrarian actions in an area could certainly overstretch the Free State. And you know, so I think that there is a interesting kind of symbiotic dynamic between anti-treaty resistance to the state and agrarian discontents that adds to that, the so-called chaos and anarchy of 1923. You know,
yeah, I mean, I think ideologically as well, though, it's also very important, because the idea of the land for the people, that the Irish people are the real owners of the land, and that the landlords, you know, are an alien caste, a colonial caste, which of course is only partly true. And it's only partly true, especially after the Windham Act of 1908, where a lot of farmers buy their land. But still, the land for the people, that every Irishman is entitled to his bit of land, is really important. And the person who can, the side which can portray themselves as the champion of this, has a really important mental or psychological tool, I think. So, especially in politics after the Civil War, I think this is underestimated, just how important this is. And again, one thing that people would say, which I think is true, is that if you look at who wins the Civil War, it's the farmers. The farmers win the Civil War. Why? Because the Free State apparatus, security apparatus, puts down strikes in Waterford very violently. They put down land seizures in rural areas. So the farm, Dan, again, Patrick Hogan, Kevin O'Higgins, explicitly say we must build the Free State on the farmers, which again is not an illogical thing to say. They need taxes. The state's bankrupt. They need these people to export. But I think that if you look at the results of the Irish Revolution, this is right at the center of what happens, you know.
Yeah. And another factor that kind of shapes the sort of, because now we're kind of, I think we're heading into the direction kind of discussing the outcomes of the revolution and the question of how conservative or how radical a revolution it was. And I think one of the things that kind of shapes the outcome of the revolution, as well as the sort of military defeat of the anti-treaty IRA, is the fact that immigration becomes, you know, the so-called safety valve again. Yeah. That immigration stopped essentially for all intents and purposes during the time of the First World War, mm-hmm. and large numbers of young people who would have immigrated, landless people who were unlikely to inherit land, found themselves in Ireland. And of course, there was a tendency for the British authorities to assume that that had something to do with the Sinn Féin kind of opposition. Other historians have not, necessarily endorsed that theory. But there's clearly many people here who would have immigrated who didn't. Now, some of that got sucked up into the British Army and the war effort. But nonetheless, after the conclusion of the First World War, you start having immigration pick up again. And so one of the safety valves that I think that the Free State benefited from, there was the temporary safety valve of creating a massive army. Over 50,000 men brought into it from basically the summer to the to early winter 1922. They created an army overnight that brought in tens and tens of thousands, both rural and urban.
In a time of intense economic crisis.
Absolutely. Yeah, the post-war economic, essentially recession, high unemployment. But then at the time of demobilization, which, created, among other things, the sort of army mutiny episode and some of those tensions, really the mass immigration, I think, was the safety valve. And, and so I've done some research on IRA immigration after the Civil War. And, IRA inspection reports from late 1923, 1924, 25, 26, 27, stressed the large numbers of men who were leaving. And there was essentially hemorrhaging of active volunteers and would-be volunteers from the countryside, from the cities, from the towns. And it really helped crippled the IRA and its plans of having some kind of renewed campaign. Mm-hmm. And then that would just be within the IRA, but obviously more broadly, large numbers of people. And even though this was the period of the 1920s when the United States, which was the primary destination, created these quotas and new protocols and new sort of restrictions on immigration. And so that, frankly, the Free States number, quota number didn't really, it wasn't, the quotas weren't set up to prevent immigration from Britain and Ireland. They're quite racist, and they were intended to prevent, immigration from Asia and from Southern Europe and elsewhere. So anyways, large numbers of Irish people were able to come over. And so I think that has something to do with the outcome of the revolution as well, is that I think it was an assumption, an implicit assumption from Patrick Pearse on, it would go back into the 19th century, that British misrule in Ireland created the conditions for immigration, and that Irish independence would lead to the end of mass immigration, and the country could have three times the population. And that was all assumed. And I think that one of one of the sadder outcomes of the revolution and an underappreciated outcome was that mass immigration started again through the 1920s, obviously ended at the time of the Great Depression for a time, and went in different directions in the 1950s, to Britain rather than to the U.S. But nonetheless, I think that has something to do with the outcome of the revolution, the fact that people who might have been on the ground and in the country with their discontents, their agrarian discontents, particularly defeated anti-treatyites, ultimately, took the boat and weren't here. So that's one of the, to play with a counterfactual, what if they hadn't left? What if they had stayed? What, we could have had some kind of reignition of the Civil War, perhaps, at some point in the mid to late 20s, if the IRA were in a position to organize on a mass basis again,
Sure. I mean, that brings me to, I guess, a final question, which is nicely alluded to there. The end of the Irish Civil War is a time of great disillusion on all sides, really. The pro-treatyites have won, but they're not particularly happy with having won. The other side are crushed. They're really disillusioned. So 1923, the Irish Revolution triumphant or the Irish Revolution betrayed?
Yeah, that's a really tough question. I mean, if you go back to earlier moments of the revolution, there are moments of triumph, or the triumph of failure, as was famously said about the 1916 rising. But there were moments when, were clearly, I think, that the people who took part in it and sacrificed so much and threw so much of their energy and hearts and souls into the national cause had reason to celebrate. And you think of all these sort of celebratory moments around the 1917 by-elections and the 1918 election and even the truce, which many people, we were talking about that earlier, actively celebrated, and bonfires were lit, and many people assumed the war had been won and independence was nigh, and you know, and then yet the Civil War, this last, you know, chapter or last phase, last moment of the Irish Revolution, really forces a much more pessimistic, you know, kind of outlook on the period. And I think that pessimism, that and demoralization, and sense of tragedy that the Civil War produces is precisely why to have a more triumphant and positive kind of narrative and interpretation of that period, you know, the so-called four glorious years, is you have to truncate. You have to have the four glorious years, not the seven or the eight or the nine or the ten.
Yeah.
Because if you put it, if you include the Civil War, you know, it complicates a more celebratory narrative of the period, which is why, you know, obviously so many books about the period and so many memoirs written by, you know, active figures in the IRA and the Bureau of Military History Project all, you know, had a tendency to kind of end the revolution at the truce in 1921.
Yeah.
When it is positive, I think, to end on a very, on a more celebratory note, the Civil War massively complicates that. Mm-hmm. In the broader picture, if you were to step back, you know, you could still argue a lot was achieved, and maybe that wasn't entirely clear to everyone at the time based upon the animosities that had been generated by the Civil War. But as I alluded to, there was also that argument that some people could maybe take some comfort from, that, well, we had our Civil War, but you know, all countries have civil wars. I still think of the Civil War as a conflict that's not been fully sort of digested, sort of, or processed, and that its meaning is still somewhat elusive, because I, at all these elements we've been talking about, the specter of really quite significant state violence, at the same time all of the anarchy and chaos that in some ways seemed to undo the gains of Sinn Féin, you know, all the constructive work. That's what, he was a very staunch pro-treatyite, but, you know, P.S. O'Hegarty, you know, talked about all the great constructive work of Sinn Féin, and then it was washed away in the blood-red tide, in his view, of gunmen, young gunmen, not even before the Civil War, in his view, you know.
Yeah, right.
But that same argument, many people, I think, were just deeply disillusioned. People who, put a lot into the struggle, just basically looked back at the Civil War and just kind of, maybe just closed the book on that period. And maybe that has something to do with the silences around the period. I mean, my current project is an oral history looking at family memory of specifically of the Civil War, but, you know, inevitably talking about grandparents and uncles and aunts and that participated in the revolution. And it really is quite amazing that while there are a lot of stories, and obviously it comes down to individuals, some relatives who might have been very loquacious or people have talked to great length about it, there are a lot of people who took part in this, in the events, these seminal historic events that really defined modern Ireland, who didn't talk much about it.
No.
And I think the Civil War, whether it's specifically the Civil War phase or just the entire period, their activism, I think the Civil War has a lot to do with why the period is so difficult to celebrate and commemorate in a way that's not polarizing. It doesn't just bring up the old issues and the old debates. And so kind of silence or circumspection or, you know, kind of a distance from the events was kind of a necessary and, you know, understandable reaction.
That was John Dorney talking with Professor Gavin Foster of Concordia University. You've been listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. Check us out on Facebook on www.facebook.com/TheIrishHistoryShow.